So welcome back to Interviews About Change. This is a series where I sit down with different tarot readers and discuss why some people get stuck, why others don't, and how to get yourself unstuck. If you are just jumping in now to this series, you can find the rest on my blog at thehermitslamp.com and click Tarot Blog, or you can look me up on iTunes by searching The Hermit's Lamp or Andrew McGregor, and you can subscribe to the audio portion of my regular blogging efforts that way. And now,
my name is James Wells, and I am somebody who does my best in my work and my life to live counsel mind. That is, try to listen as deeply as possible, try to respond as authentically as possible. And my work includes working with tarot, which has been my best friend and therapist, as I like to say, for the last 31 plus years, and involves a circle process, a way of communicating, weaving community, weaving connection, harvesting wisdom with pairs, groups, communities, certainly with Reiki in a very traditional manner, which not only sees it as energy healing work, but also realizes that it is a path to self-realization or enlightenment or satori or individuation or whatever you want to call that, and a big advocate for journal writing, and teach that one-on-one or in groups as well, and the journal being a consistent record of our inner life. And so those are my four main tools in working with myself and my own life and in working with other people who consult me.
And the reason that I'm talking to you today is to ask you about change, getting stuck, and getting unstuck. So I'm wondering what you see as the most common or some of the most common reasons that yourself or other people get stuck.
Just like to hear a statement, first of all, for what getting stuck means for you.
So getting stuck means something like, I really want a new job, and we've delineated a bunch of reasons and ideas about how that can go about happening, and yet I am unable to take any steps in that direction, or any other area of life in
right,
that way, where a road is available, a road is open, and there's no obvious reason not to do it, and yet the person still sort of stays where they are.
I really feel that there's a piece of our consciousness as human beings that perceives any change as death or annihilation, certainly scary. So we're tempted to stay with the familiar in order to stay alive or not be annihilated, not have our ego wiped out, not be killed, so to speak. Even if whatever we are not changing is unhealthy for us, might even be killing us. You know, I think of someone who was attending a workshop that I was giving in Ottawa last year, and he asked me something along the same line. He has a daughter who is in an extremely, extremely abusive marriage, physically and psychologically, and he felt really helpless about, you know, this, and he just said to me, why is she doing this? And I said, because it would mean changing. You know, her whole identity is wrapped in being the wife of this person. You know, she knows nothing else, and to leave that behind, at least in this stage, would be tantamount to killing herself in a way. It'd be like, if her whole identity is wrapped up in that role, if that role is suddenly removed, you know, that could be pretty traumatic for her. Even though, you know, he's doing things like pointing guns at her at 3 a.m. and stuff like this, which is certainly not healthy. But it's familiar to her. Certainly, it's almost become cliche to say that in some circles, but it's still true. That which is uncomfortably comfortable.
The devil you know versus the devil you don't, right?
Yeah, exactly. Good way to put it. You know, the devil we know at least might not be great company, but it's at least company that's familiar. And to step into the unknown is, you know, kind of like the fool in the tarot wanting to, you know, ready to step off that cliff. Oh, is there a trampoline down below, or am I just going to splat on the rocks?
Right.
It's the uncertainty. And I really do believe there's a piece of our consciousness, though, that feels that it's a threat to our ego self, the persona that we've built up over years or decades or whatever. And we've invested so much time and energy in becoming who we think we are that to instigate any major change anyway, even transformation, which I want to get into in a little while, would be like suicide.
So I know that you've been through a lot of change recently in your life, and I'm wondering what you did with yourself to encourage you to engage that change, to stick to that change, and to find your way through it, or, you know, even if you're still continuing it.
Are you talking about the relational changes that have been going on in my life?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's certainly been going on. Good changes and creative changes, as I've been changing in the last several months, almost a year, is to have an arena or forum for expressing what's going on and to be, have that witnessed. So, for instance, I belong to several different circle-based groups, some of them based around healing and change and peacemaking, and some based around shamanic work, and others just simply people who support each other in their self-employed work. And those circles are wonderful outlets. I can check in and say, you know what, this is going on in my life, and I just need to express it right now, and I don't need any feedback on it. I just need to express what's going on. And that circle-based space is and time is very safe. It's non-judgmental, or as non-judgmental as we can get. They're simply there to witness my process, and I am there to witness their process. And so there's this lack of fixing, making better. For me, what's helped me in the change process is having those containers for safe expression. And that includes the small groups, the larger groups of which I'm a part, and even one-on-one conversations with the two principal people involved in the changes in my personal life. And hearing each other and saying what's really on our mind to each other and yet not judging. And then there are times when I do want feedback, and I will say, you know, I'm about to express something, and I would love some feedback on that. You know, how does it feel to you? What do you hear in what I'm saying? That kind of stuff. And the other safe space for me is my journal. My journal is one of my sanity lines, one of my lifelines. Seriously, you could put anything on the page, or at least I can put anything on the page, and I know that it's safe space because the people who know me well respect this book sitting around on the table or on my in my writing space, and they know that it's sacred to me, and they hold that sacred as well. And so I can write what's on my mind, the good, the bad, the ugly, the indifferent, the joyous, anything at all can go on the page. And it's kind of like having a, you know, if you go get a book from a dollar store and use it as your journal, you've got therapy for a buck.
So what I'm hearing and what you're saying is a lot of just really the first step is almost honoring where you're at, no matter where that is, whether it's where you'd like to be, whether you're comfortable with it, and not keeping a stiff upper lip and just trucking through or trying to hold on to it, but just saying, hey, this is really where I'm at, and
ultimately,
then proceeding from there.
We can start. You know,
it's true.
This is where we are. I mean, if something happened to me when I was 4 years old, well, whoop-de-doo, that was 40 years ago. I can't do much about that, but I can do something about how I'm feeling now and what my experience is now.
And when you're doing a reading with people, or when you're working with people in circle or in your journaling work with people, do you do things, are there steps you take to try and help them get to that space at the beginning?
Yeah, usually actually the steps, the bigger steps, the more consciously sculpted steps on my part, occur towards the end of the consultation, particularly if I'm working with tarot or even just sitting and listening and witnessing their story in kind of a sort of counseling session kind of thing. I usually tend to get more into the let's do something about it towards the end. But I do set the tone for the proactive bit even before they come to me. I've got a series of 5 questions that I send to people often by email, or might ask them by phone if they're calling for the appointment, especially for first-timers who haven't experienced my work yet. So would you like me to just say what those 5 questions are?
I would love that.
Okay, good. So I'm going to presume that this is somebody coming to me for a tarot consultation. And I tend to use the word session or consultation rather than reading, because for me, anyway, reading implies that I'm simply going to sit here and read the cards at them, whereas in a consultation or session, we're working together and we're consulting our sources of wisdom through and using the cards as a catalyst. Anyway, but that's just a technicality. So the first question I ask is, why do you seek a tarot consultation and why now? The second one I ask is, what goals and desires would you like to make a reality? Third one, what challenges or issues are you currently experiencing? The fourth one is very key for me. It's, what are your expectations about what a tarot consultation can do for you? That fourth question kind of helps me gauge a little bit of the mindset. You know, are they looking for a quick fix? Are they looking for a miracle? Are they looking for just some friendly feedback? Are they looking to tap into their inner wisdom? Are they looking to have me guess the future for them, you know, so I can kind of gauge whether I need to educate them a little bit or whether maybe I need to pass them on to somebody else who does something other than what I do, et cetera. The fifth question, the final one, is what are your specific objectives for our time together, which I sometimes also word as how will you know that our time together has been worthwhile? So we're going from the general, you know, what kind of, why are you seeking a session, your desires, your issues, your expectations, okay, taking all that into account, what do you want in that hour or hour and a half or 2 hours that we're together? You know, what do you hope to accomplish? And so that helps me to create or choose a layout or a process that we both feel will be of value based upon what their intent is. And that series of questions helps them get to clear about our intent. So I guess that brings the idea in that in order to make change in our lives, to bring it into your general umbrella here, it never hurts to have an intent of some kind.
Well, it seems to me, too, that your process, whether they're clear about it before they start or not, it at least creates a preliminary clarity about what is it that they need. You know, what is it that they're actually trying to get, not just out of your session, but also of their lives. And I think
ultimately
that's it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that when we communicate that, when we state that aloud, you know, it percolates into our unconscious as well and sets us up better to work, to get the information we want in the session and to be more open ultimately because there's a promise of something that's actually in line with what we need.
Right, which is one reason I don't do same-day sessions. I don't take people who call me and say, I need to see you today. I say, well, no, you don't. It's because I really want them to reflect on this and to let those ideas percolate inside their consciousness. Like you said, it's kind of a, whether conscious or unconsciously, there's something brewing inside that prepares both of us for the session. You know, I can become clearer as well. It's not just about them. It's teamwork here. So it helps both of us be better hosts for what wants to come up in their session.
Do you feel the readings come before the person shows up?
What do you mean by that?
Well, some people, with longstanding clients of mine, I will sometimes start thinking about them for a couple of days before they call me. Sometimes when somebody's coming for a session, I will feel like I'm getting some intuitive guidance about what they might even need.
Okay, good.
Or how to handle the session with them before they arrive.
Right. This is why their responses to the questions are helpful, because they're kind of my homework. Then I can design a layout of cards or a map of cards, or I can pick a process that I know that I feel will serve their needs. So, and sometimes I work with people's birth cards, so I'll use the numbers of their birth date to work out specific cards that apply to their lifetime or specific years in their life, and we can discuss the stories in those cards as they pertain to their life and maybe get more of a larger story. So I do a little homework ahead of time, but I'm not trying to tune in, as it were, because we're not in session. But I do a little bit of preliminary work. The session begins when we sit down to do the session, for me anyway. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if I'm out at a party or something and says, oh, you do tarot, like, what do you pick up about me? And I go, well, I don't bill what I do as a psychic reading, first of all, and second of all, we're not in session. So I'm here to enjoy the party, just like you.
Yeah, I sometimes lie to people when I'm at parties because, you know, I don't necessarily want to spend the whole evening talking to people about what I do. So I'll tell them I'm something really boring, like an accountant or a tax person or something. And they're like, oh, really? That's nice. Like, so what about that? But I'm really into bicycling. Let's talk about bicycling, you know?
Yeah. I'm with you on that. What else about change?
So what about transformation? You brought up the idea of transformation. I love the word transformation, the idea of transformation. And yet I think that it's really charged. I think that a lot of people have really varying ideas of what that means, from I'm going to walk in and something's going to happen and I'm going to walk out different, to that road is so long and so hard and there's so much work in front of me that I can't even begin it, to all sorts of really positive ideas as well. So what do you think about transformation? Why do you like that word or not like that word?
Well, one of my big soapboxes in the last short while, in fact, you may have, I know that Fleur read the blog entry. I wrote a piece recently called Honoring Transformation, and it's about, from my point of view, rescuing the word transformation from buzzword hell. In other words, it's a word we hear a lot in workshops that people inclined our way tend to go to. It's a word that's printed a lot in books that are geared towards people who do what we do or who use our types of services. It's something we banty about even in conversation with our colleagues, with our clients, with our mentors and friends. And I love the word. I'm in love with the word transformation. What I'm not in love with is just how common it's become. You know, it's kind of like instead of facial tissue, people say Kleenex. And so my whole thing on transformation and versus change is that transformation's big. It permeates every piece of one's life. To transform means to change the form of energy. It means to go beyond the form in which you currently find yourself or in which something currently is. It means to be reshaped totally. I think of Scorpio and the death card when I think of transformation. I think Scorpio brings us into elimination and total transition. It brings us into the underworld journey of initiation. It brings us into shamanic dismemberment so that one can be put back together again in one's more authentic form. It's not to be taken lightly. And I'm calling to mind something that Marianne Woodman, the post-Jungian analyst, she's almost 83. She lives in London, Ontario, and she was doing a workshop and a lecture and so forth. One of them I was at anyway. She said, there can be no transformation without sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there can be no transformation without sacrifice. And those words have rung like a huge gong in my head ever since she spoke them to us. And I think there's also a misconception about what sacrifice is. And I think part of the reason people are afraid to change is because they're afraid to make the necessary sacrifice. And sacrifice does not necessarily mean giving something up. It means offering something to the sacred, whatever one considers to be sacred. You know, it's sacre and facere. Facere meaning to make or to do, and sacre, anything to do with the sacred, the holy. And for some people, the sacred is goddess or god, and for some people, the sacred is their family. For some people, the sacred is the life of the earth, whatever. So it's making an offering to that thing, that being, that energy that one holds as sacred. You know, what am I willing to offer here in exchange for my transformation? If I really mean it, I need to offer something. It's kind of like walking into your office, perhaps, and somebody saying, hey, Andrew, I'd like you to do 5 hours of tarot work with me, and then to say, and you saying, well, my fee for that will be $X. And they say, oh, well, I don't really want to do that. Bye.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how serious are they about the session? I mean, just throwing that out as an example that quickly comes to mind.
It's interesting as you're talking about this. So we're talking about the death card, which you sort of typifies transformation, and I might choose to use the word transmutation.
Yeah.
Which is very similar, you know, the change from one state to another.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that in light of the quote from Marianne Woodman, that seeking to transform without sacrifice is like the hangman. It might get you halfway there, but the thing that you need to sacrifice, or the thing that you need to let go of, will hold you back. And also that there's this idea of the third card comes to mind, which is the Tower card, which is...
Mm-hmm.
Not transformation, but destruction, but the breaking down of things.
Yeah, for me, it's a card of catalyzing the changes. You know, and I see the difference between death and the tower in the tarot a bit like the difference between the myths of Inanna and Persephone in classical mythology. You know, Inanna, queen of heaven and later queen of heaven and earth, wanted to go see her sister Eriskigal in the underworld, and she consciously prepared for that. She said, I'm going to be going down there for X number of days. If any of you up here don't see me within this time, here are the very specific actions I want you to take in order to bring me back safely. So she consciously prepared, and she went through 7 layers of removing things. You know, first of all, her crown, and then her clothing, and then her jewelry. And so she was totally stark naked in the underworld. But she did that slowly, a step at a time, a stage at a time, and prepared for it and told others and had backup.
Mm-hmm.
Persephone got abducted. Slurp. Hades hauled her into the underworld. No preparation involved. What the hell was that? So I kind of see the death card as the Inanna story, you know. It's more at the fear of using yet another overused word, organic, And whereas the Tower and Persephone is more of a kapow, the lightning bolt catalyst, the whirlpool that slurps you under.
That's great. I love that distinction.
Mm-hmm. And so we have a choice here. So if we notice things are shifting in our lives, we're going, okay, am I just going to pretend that's not happening, blah, la, 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 la. You know, like Persephone, we're going to get sucked into the change experience or transformation experience if we're not becoming aware of it. You talked about, and we talked about just a little while ago, about knowing where you are, you know, changing from where you are. If you're not aware of what's going on around you right now in this moment, you're going to experience your own abduction into whatever the situation is. Whereas, if we become a little more conscious, and this is how I like to use the tarot and my other feedback tools, it's just a way of noticing what's happening now. What do I need to be conscious of now? What do I need to learn or embody or become aware of at this moment?
I think that if we look at the different parts of the self too, you know, we've got our higher self or, you know, whatever, our God up in God or goddess or whatever sort of self. And then we've got our consciousness, and then we've got our underworld, right? We've got where our shadow lives. And, you know, I think that deliberately and consciously choosing and embarking on a journey to go and communicate with your underworld, with your shadow self, is incredibly powerful. But I think that what happens for a lot of people is that their shadow self never gets noticed until it's abducted them. And even then, they may not recognize that that's what's going on.
Right. There are some people who would prefer to think that this happened to them from some outside agency. And sometimes it is. You know, sometimes it's an earthquake or a flood or a relative suddenly dies in an accident or something. We did not ask for those or choose those things. But so there are external agents there. That said, I do believe in the choice-centered model I try to live and try to encourage that we have a choice about how to respond to those.
So you mentioned the idea of support in the Inanna story. You know, she got the support of her peers, her whoever, everybody else up there, right?
Yeah.
And so what ways do you think that people can reach out for support? You know, I mean, obviously you run Circle Process. You have your group of peers that you get sort of business support around, and you know, you do your Reiki exchanges and all sorts of stuff. Mm-hmm. But what kind of support do you think other people should be asking for if they don't necessarily have these things?
It's so individual. It really is so individual. I certainly wouldn't want to make a blanket statement to everybody that, you know, method A, B, or C is definitely going to be your cure-all or your help-all. It essentially boils down to ask for what it is you need.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what am I feeling right now? What do I need in order to work my way through this? Or what do I need in order to support this? What might I need? Or I don't know what the hell I need. It's okay to say that.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay to say to life, to one's friends, to one's relatives, to one's trusted ones, whether they're blood relatives or your chosen family, you know, I haven't got a clue what the heck is going on with me right now. I just need you to understand that I'm going through something. And if you can think of anything, I'm open to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And for some people, that might mean a therapist. For some people, that might mean just letting them go through it. For some people, it might be, I don't know, energy work. For some people, it might be doing ceremonies in their tradition or in a tradition with which they resonate to help them go through rites of passage a bit at a time. And that's another thing I think that's in our culture here. There aren't enough rites of passage anymore at specific times of life. You know, in Christianity, certainly there was and still is, I guess, in certain branches, you know, you were baptized. Then you became confirmed later on as at your own choice, usually in your late tens, early teens, your tweens. And then you were able to receive communion. And then for more traditional people, in more traditional types of relationships, there's the sacrament of marriage. And so these rites of passage going through, and the sacrament of confession and so forth, in which people got to get what's off their chest. So there's this gradual stage of things. There's the burial rites. I'm just speaking from one tradition, and certainly in many indigenous cultures around the world, there were times and are, I think in some places, still times that are marked, you know, when you're born, when you become a certain age, when you reach puberty, when you reach womanhood or manhood, one of the spilling of a man's first seed, the flowing of a young woman's first blood, all these things being marked, partnered with somebody, going through death, all mm-hmm. these kinds of things. There were specific cultural rituals to go through in order to maintain the harmony between the community and the cosmos at large. They were always in connection with the environment in which they lived and always designed with the well-being of all of life in mind. And I really don't see a lot of that happening in our culture right now. So I think another resistance to change or transformation in us is that we don't have these gradual gateways like Inanna had to take us through specific rituals, through specific events that symbolically mark these changes in our life. To have changes marked regularly in one's life makes change less scary.
Mm-hmm. And it's not as some internet marketers would have you believe. And here are 7 easy guaranteed steps to take you from step A to step B where you will be happy and transformed.
In 2 days or less.
For $29.95. And I think that the other thing that is once we have a sense of the change that we want or need, which is the first step, whether you're taking it to a therapist or to a reading or a consultation or whatever you're engaging, asking that process, how do I get through this now? How do I make this change? How do I, you know, make this easier on myself, or how do I manage it, is a great way to go into a session.
How is a wonderful word. And that's how I often end my sessions with people. I often take them through a little activity at the end of the tarot session. The last 5 to 10 minutes might be, okay, out of all the cards we've got laid out here, which one most looks like you would love to become it? You know, maybe 6 months down the road or even 2 years down the road, you could say to yourself, wow, I'm really glad I became like that card. And then we set all the rest aside and we put that single card in front of them and I say, name a bunch of qualities that you see in this card that you like, feelings that you notice, activities you see going on that feel positive, constructive, helpful, and just name them out loud. And I jot them down for them. I say to them quite often, okay, now you've named these qualities, X, Y, and Z. What can you see yourself doing over the next 24 hours and committing to, it's not too big, but not too small, that you can say looks or feels like qualities X, Y, or Z that you've just named? And then just get them to commit to one small activity over the next 24 hours. And then I say, now project yourself over the next week. What looks or feels like qualities X, Y, or Z over the next week? What one thing can you do over the next week? And then the same for over the next month. And I find that once I get those teeny tiny things going, and I do this for myself too, it's not just for the people who come to me, I do this for myself all the time. I find that once those first 2 or 3 activities are done, I show myself, oh, I'm actually able to do something a little bit different than I usually do. I'm able to break out of the devil I know, so to speak, or the familiar territory. I can dip my toe outside of familiar territory a little bit. And that's something I think that we forget, that we don't have to have the transformation overnight. I'm fond of saying to my clients that it doesn't have to be solved here at the table. We can try changes on for a while. We can't try on transformation for a while. That either is or isn't. But we can try on little changes for a while, kind of like trying on a cologne for a few days or trying on a friend's sweater for a couple of weeks just to kind of see, do I like it, do I not? You know, so we can try a form of behavior, we can try a new vocabulary, we can try new ways of responding to specific situations in which we consistently find ourselves, and we could try it on for a while. You know, maybe there's somebody we admire, they deal with such and such type of work situation really well. Maybe I could try a little bit of what they do when I go into work for the next 2 weeks and just see what it's like. And at the end of the 2 weeks or the month or whatever you decide, you can assess it and say, it kind of worked for me. I'm going to keep it exactly as it is. And I said, you know, it worked, but I could see how I could tweak it to make it more my own. Or we might say, you know what, that's not really me, and it feels phony when I do it, and I don't want to do it anymore. And we can discard it. So we can try change on for a short time. And then assess whether we like it or not, or whether it's helping us or not.
I really like the idea that we're looking, when people are looking towards the future, when I look towards the future, sometimes I get immobilized by the years. You know, I'm like, well, in 5 years I want to be here, and, you know, in 15 years my kids will be this age. You know, I look at these things sometimes, and I get stuck in them occasionally, and I certainly see people get stuck in them when I'm working with them. And I was talking with a client that I've been doing some reading and coaching work with, who is in the process of making a 3-year plan to grow their business. And I had to remind them many times that this plan is A, changeable, and B, just a whole bunch of days, one after the other. It's a way of creating a plan that allows you to have the next step laid out in front of you. I'll do this, and then once that's done, then I'll do that, and then I'll do this, and then I'll do this. And all you have to do is it becomes more about showing up than looking way down the road all the time.
It's Angeli Zarian in her work on the Fourfold Way talks about the way of the warrior or leader, which is simply choose to be present, to show up. You know, and I think that's the mark of a true leader, just show up. And it, what you're talking about makes me think that a series of gradual small changes could even accumulate enough over the years to become eventually a transformation.
As the pattern shifts, there comes a point where even though you're going 9.1, 9.2, 9.3, at some point you're closer to 10 than you are to 9, as long as you keep moving. And I think that the keep moving and showing up is really key. You know, I know for me that in terms of my exercise and routines and stuff, there are lots of days where I say to myself, all you got to do is go to the gym. If you're going to go to the gym, you can turn around and come home after once you're there, but all you got to do is just get there. And then once I'm there, then I start and stuff happens, you know. So just showing up can be really powerful when the actual work that's entailed by committing to show up and do the work might be too daunting.
And sometimes, you know, making change in our lives is simply inconvenient to some people. You know, I think of myself. I live a part of town that's fairly close to the Bloor subway line. I'm just a 4-minute walk from a subway station here, so that's nice and handy. And it also happens to be a spot where a couple of buses go past to go to places where I often go. And in the better weather, it just makes more sense for me to walk to these places. But before I get to the end of the road, there's the station. You know, if I just sort of think, oh, you know, it'd be just more convenient for me to get on the bus here or the subway here. And if I find if I just take those 10 more steps and round the corner, go round the station and see the actual distance down the road that my destination is, I'm going, you know, that's not so bad after all. So sometimes making changes in our lives just feels inconvenient to us when if we just took those 1, 2, or 10 little steps. We could see, you know, it's really not that hard, James.
It's true. And sometimes it is. Sometimes making a big transformation can be a great big pain in the butt in terms of disrupting our life, our living situation, our financial security. But that's also not a reason to avoid it if it's really important.
There's one other thing that I feel I should bring into this, is that sometimes there are other circumstances that prevent people from making the changes or transformations that are required. They may have somebody threatening their life, saying, if you make this change, I will kill you and myself. Or they may want to take this art course they've been dying to take for the last 2 years, but they're saying, oh, God, it's $1,000. You know, I don't have $1,000. I'm busy paying off my Visa card, and if I take on any more debt, I'm just going to totally screw myself. So forth. You know, that said, once again, all right, so you can't take the art course. What can you do? Maybe you go to a discount store and you buy a $2 blank book and a $2 box of crayons, and maybe you go to the library for 1 hour a week and try out some techniques in an art book you see in the library. You know, so sometimes there are circumstances in people's lives that just, you know, maybe they're a single parent with three kids to feed and they're working two jobs just to keep body and soul together. You know, I've only had a couple people like that call me and saying, oh, I really need some help. You know, I haven't got enough money to pay for this. And I said, you know what? You don't need to be paying me $145 an hour for a consultation. You need to go to the grocery store and buy you and your kids groceries this week. You know, call me when your circumstances are better. And one of them certainly did and said, I'm glad you made me wait. That was kind of a dumb thing I did calling you. And they said, now I'm in better circumstances. I'd like to examine how I can make other changes now that I made this other change of getting a better paying job and I don't have to work two jobs and blah, 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 you know?
Yeah, I think a lot.
Sorry.
That's okay. I was going to say, I think some people expect that there will come a miracle out of the reading, that they will go to the reading and then they will go to the bingo hall that night and win enough money to fix their life or, you know, what have you, or some other variation of that. And, you know, that stuff is just unrealistic. We have to, it may happen, it's possible, but generally speaking, it's better to be practical about such things. If you already know that it's a bad idea, even if a reading confirms it and you know it's a bad idea, you still shouldn't do it. And I think that's where having a reader that you trust and have a good relationship with is also important, because people go and who knows who's telling them what and why, and whether they're just kind of leading them on, whether they're really clear about it, the person doing the reading, or, you know, whether they just mean well, you know, but it certainly can be a problem.
Yeah, for sure. It goes down to where is a good ear for me. If I'm going through changes, I need a good ear, and I need somebody who, at least I would want somebody with remembers who that they've got two ears and one mouth, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Like, okay, I need you more to listen, and once in a while you can chime in. You know, and I think a good reader, consultant, whatever, does that. You know, provides sacred time and space for the person to let go of what's on their mind and just spill it and say, okay, great. Based on that, I think we could do process F, G, or H, and let's try that out. Or I might say, you know what? I don't feel qualified to handle the change you're experiencing, but I do know someone who I feel is.
Mm-hmm.
So knowing when to refer as a professional, too, is a good thing. And I've certainly done that with a few people, and they've been thrilled with the people they've gone to who were able to meet their needs where they were at. And when I sort of said, I'm not comfortable doing that, that's not how I work, or that type of change feels that you're going through feels like you need, you know, a psychotherapist right now, here's a number I've got of a good one. Or, you know what, I might check in with my medical doctor around this if I were you, because I'm wondering whether there's something chemical here and I'm not qualified to deal with that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think you posted something on your site a little while ago, a quote from Yodorovsky about wanting readers who had experience, who had scars, or, you know, I forget the exact quote, but, you know, that had life experience. And I think that everybody has different life experience. And, you know, there are some topics and situations where talking to somebody who's been through what you're going through is really, really helpful.
It's true. I mean, some of the best tarot people I know are people who have lived some interesting stuff. And you know, there may be a reason why in traditional Kabbalah they said you needed to be at least 40 years old and be established with your family and all that stuff. It's because you need to be grounded in the real world before taking off into the esoteric realms. And it just makes a heck of a lot of sense.
Absolutely. Well, is there anything else that you wanted to cover before we wrap this up?
Well, I think what I would like to do is a simple two-card reading, if I might.
Oh, please.
One, for what prevents the non-changers from making changes in their lives, and two, what motivates the changers to make changes in their lives? I mean, broad umbrella term for both of those camps. You know, the people we perceive as not making changes in their life and those we perceive as making changes. So, you know, what prevents the non-changers from making changes in their lives and what motivates the changers to make changes in their lives. So I'm using the Royal Fez Moroccan Tarot, which looks a little bit like the Rider-Waite-Smith one, but slightly redone. So what I have here for what prevents the non-changers from making changes in their lives is the Ten of Swords upright. So a few things pop into my head when I look at that. First of all, there's this dramatic picture of somebody lying dead across a rock with 10 swords in their back. And so I think it just reiterates this idea that I spoke of earlier, that there's some piece of our consciousness, of our mind, the realm of the swords, which perceives change as complete annihilation, dramatic death. And certainly some traditions see this card as a fear of ruin, of totally dismantling one's life and destroying one's life.
Mm-hmm. And picture the worst thing that's going to happen, right?
Yeah, worst-case scenario kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And you know, the tens for me also hesitate, procrastinate, take a break from, and the swords, being in the realm of the mind, also take us into our lifestyle, how we live out our mind and our ideas. And so the non-changers, it suggests, might generally be people who have a lifestyle of procrastination, you know, who sometimes see themselves distant from the laws of life, when the laws of life just are that everything changes. And yet they see themselves as different from that or set apart from that. Oh, no, I'm different. You know, creating self-fulfilling prophecies, too, of disaster, just when I look at this card. So there's some thoughts about why the non-changers might not change. Mm-hmm. And I would, you know, certainly if you get people offering feedback from this recording, I would love to hear their thoughts on the Ten of Swords about why non-changers don't make changes. So the second card, what motivates the changers to make changes in their lives? And I get Five of Pentacles upright. In this particular version of the Five of Pentacles, the five coins are appearing, as in the Waitsmith one, sort of in a window or door thing, but they're radiating. It's almost like it's a vision appearing, and the guy with the crutches and the woman with the hood have a third party there, someone who's just standing there beside them, and she's kneeling on the ground, and the guy in the crutches is standing on the crutches, but they're all facing this portal or doorway, which looks like a vision with these five pentacles in it and the snow in the background. So there's a suggestion here that what motivates changers to make changes in their lives is kind of an aha moment. You know, these people are looking towards this vision as if, wow, I wasn't expecting that. It's kind of a revelation, and the pentacles bring us into the realm of reality, the tangible, the material, the physical, the grounded. And the fives, for me, are about change and adjusting and challenging. And so, we'll piece that together, it's like what motivates the changers is this aha moment that, oh, my real world is changing anyway. Well, why don't I flow with it? It just kind of makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so there's a sense of, oh, well, the nature of life is to change. Duh, my tangible circumstances are changing. Ding dong. Why don't I just look it right in the face and see where it wants to take me? What's the doorway that's opening in this moment that's changing?
That's great. I love the image of a doorway for the kind of change we're discussing too, you know, because it often is we go through the door and close it behind us and that's it. Mm-hmm. You know, we go on with the rest of our life. And from one side of the door, it can be filled with fear and trepidation, but from the other side of the door, more often than not, it's filled with, what door? Did I go through a door? I'm so busy enjoying what's on this side, I don't even think about it anymore.
Uh-huh, yeah, for sure. And some people, in some traditions, see the Five of Pentacles as a card of worry, particularly material worry. And so maybe another motivation for the changers is, oh, I'm worried that this is really sucks right now. And the worry is simply an emotion, and emotions lead us somewhere. Emotions are simply indicators of something. They don't necessarily have something we have to attach to.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole idea of worry that comes with the Five of Pentacles in some schools of thought could just be, yeah, my motivation is I'm feeling a sense of worry. Something needs to change here.
Yeah, when you were talking about the depiction of the Five of Pentacles in the deck you're using, I had this sense of a transition from the glass is half empty to the, wait a second, the glass is half full, and it could be even more full. I better do something about that. Like there's sort of a shift in consciousness between that sort of more traditional Rider-Waite depiction maybe of it and the one you're describing in the card, which I thought was interesting.
And it's fascinating because in the image that most people know of the Five of Pentacles, there are only two people walking, you know, trudging together through the snow, not looking very good. There's a third person in this one, with a red hood and blonde hair and green shoes. They actually are wearing footwear. They look like they're healthy. It's almost like they're calling attention in a way to the doorway that's in which this vision is taking place. And so what motivates the changers might be they have a supportive being to stand there and point to things for them.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily do it for them, but point. Oh, look, here's a doorway. I love doing this. Thank you.
This has been Interviews About Change. You can find all of the episodes either at thehermitslamp.com and click on my blog, or you can go into iTunes and search Andrew McGregor and you will find the rest of the interviews there. Thank you for listening, and please watch for future episodes.